He had been insulted by experts in the past. If a dealership was impossible, then he would make it possible. Doubtless he annoyed them, shouting, not knowing that his power was no longer what it was.
"Give me a chance," he said. "I've got the capital."
To tell the truth, his capital was not enough. Also, he might as well hear it from them. There was the problem of confusion about Bob's motors.
"What confusion?"
"Your old man has opened up outside of Melton."
"No, he hasn't."
"Yes, he has."
"Opened what?"
"A motor business."
I can see his mouth, poor darling.
"Well, what of it?"
"Branding,"
they said, a new word that had to be explained.
"We can't deal with two Bob's Motors. Can't do it. When you see the place, you'll understand."
Of course it didn't matter that Dan had gone and opened up his own used car business on the Melbourne Road. But it mattered to my husband. In fact, it winded him.
"Sorry, Titch."
He should have come home to me. Instead, he rushed off to chat to his tormentor. 43 minutes later, he found the one-hoist garage with Bob's for Ford in fluorescent orange. Of course Dan had no franchise, never had and never could. He was a crummy second-hand car dealer with one vehicle and the deposit written in whitewash on its windscreen.
"Why are you doing this to me?"
Titch asked. The answer was, the mongrel couldn't help himself. He took his well-dressed son around the back, where beside the battery shed, he showed him a propeller rescued from the Dali tip.
"After all I did for you," he said.
Chapter 17. I was emotional, yes, but not in the way Mrs. Bobsey imagined. How could I have told her that even as I dug the graves I was happy? I was loved. I loved in turn. It was all I ever wanted. That was the immoral truth I could never tell a soul. I drove the spade deep, cutting off my own potatoes, and all the time I thought of Clover, those unflinching eyes bright behind her lashes, her tennis player's legs drawing me in deeper. I stood my spade against the side wall of the house. I washed my hands. I scrubbed the floor and made the bed. I swept the front veranda and burned the legal letters demanding child support. I saved only the envelope marked the Education Department of the State of Victoria. This I read as I dressed for the recording session. "Dear blah blah blah. As you have failed to appear as requested, the tribunal has no choice but to suspend you without pay as of the date of the offence. Should you wish to appeal this decision, you may present a sequestered defence at the meeting December 10th, 1953. What was a sequestered defence? I didn't care. I wished only to return to Clover and the studio. And what a quiz show we recorded there. A dance, in fact, floating in a field of jasmine and orange blossom. Deasy must have dealt the yellow cards, but I hardly noticed him. It was not until the final minutes that I became aware of his ferocious stare. Had he been looking like that all through the show? Perhaps. But he was a strange man with a peculiar past and wide rings on his large fingers, and I had never tried to really understand him. When Baby Deasy rewound the tape, Deasy invited me out for tea. That is, he pinched the sleeve of my jacket and, with no farewell to frowning Clover, tugged me down the stairs all the way up Collins Street, not slowly either, dragging me up Spring Street and through the grand doors of the Hotel Windsor. The waitress asked Deasy would he like scones and clotted cream. "No scones," he said, "tea." "And you, sir?" "He'll have tea," said Deasy, and chewed at his moustache until the waitress departed. "Did you root her?" he said. "What?" "Root! Fuck! Bang! Did you stoop her?" He showed his big teeth and nodded his head ferociously. You did, didn't you? I thought, what gives you the right to speak to me like this? Strike me lucky, he said. I never saw a fuck so public. She's lost her spark. You have too. If I was a sponsor, I'd take me advertising budget somewhere else. Jesus, Willie, don't shit in your own nest. Not now. I thought, I am not your dog. This is meant to be a contest, he hissed. We don't fix the questions. That's the point. Neither of you know what's going to happen next. You want to destroy her, or did you forget? She wants to kill you. That's the point. That's why we cast her. Frankly, I thought he'd gone cuckoo, with his great hands enclosing a soft pack of unfiltered cigarettes, crumbling tobacco onto the Windsor's white tablecloth. What are you looking at? This? He held the pack, pinching it between thumb and forefinger. What is it? Philip Morris cigarettes. Do you know the slogan? He asked. His eyes were far too bright. Nothing to lose but your smoker's cough. Yes. He stared at me with eyebrows raised dramatically. What would you say to a national quiz show called Nothing to Lose? They're signing on. I am this close. Nothing to Lose, brought to you by Philip Morris. We're going to have to record today's show again. I can't play them this lovey-dovey bullshit. There'll be real prize money, real check, real money you can put in the bank. We'll re-record on Wednesday, okay? You want to kill her, comprenez-vous? You want a job? Yes, I said, but frankly I wasn't certain any more. Well, piss off, I thought. Poor monster, sick with greed. It was cold and drizzly on Spring Street, but there she was, my darling, tucked into a dark doorway in her bright red overcoat. You waited, but of course. I thought, she will wish to know what Deasy said to me. I was relieved when she did not. Her nose was cold and her mouth was warm, and we bought 2 tuppenny fares on the 15 tram, and soon, minutes later, we were entering a Queen's Road apartment building. Perhaps you know the type, always divided by a long, thin garden path, punctuated by blind white statues and melancholy topiary. One of those Spanish-style blocks which had previously seemed so lost and loveless to me. We entered chastely, brother and sister, as far as all the world could see. Then the door was closed and locked, and never mind the rest. Afterwards, Clover asked me if I was pleased to have my feathers clipped, and I said nothing about the murders. I told her that I loved her, and proved it once again. We lay on musky sheets redolent of jasmine, with her hair curling upon my chest. She kissed my nose. She had discovered Adelina was living in Paran. She had seen her, she said, and my son as well. Another man might have been alarmed, but I trusted jealousy. She's in the phone book, sweetie. Your red-haired boy, she said. Oh, poor, poor Willie. Thus she spoke to me in a code, and I could now trust her absolutely. She knew, now, certainly, my true history, and she showed me how she accepted my disastrous past. I lay drowsily in the perfumed bed and watched, with the pride and vanity of ownership, her slender, athletic body, as she moved around her tiny kitchen and then brought me mushrooms on toast, and I kissed her earthy, buttery mouth, at once so strange and so familiar. Why would I ever want to kill her? I would rather lose to her, in fact. We moved from mushrooms to sparkling Rheingold. In vino veritas, by golly, only half a glass. We discussed our savings, the cost of life in Italy. I was a balloonist cutting loose the ballast, and with every slash I rose until I was once again a teenager who might become anything he wished. I told her that we had a sponsor. Somehow she already knew. We agreed we would spend weekends together. I returned to Bacchus Marsh with no one to tell me how to spend my time. The education department had lost all power over me, and yet, like many men who find themselves unemployed, I could not be idle. Now, each day, I would arrive in Melbourne just after noon and enter the State Library of Victoria when Sebastian Lasky was at lunch. That is, I would not face the map librarian just yet, or justify my inexplicable occupation. And as he never manned the desk and stayed in his office above Little Lonsdale Street, I was able to call for maps of the pastoralist properties, which lay like a lethal patchwork on top of the true tribal lands. Here, beneath Norman G. Peebles' gorgeous dome, I was at peace, transcribing the coordinates of the famous properties of Deanside and Rockbank. It was a map of murder, of course. What else was I to do? In Bacchus Marsh, I removed an entire wall of books and tacked tracing paper on the plaster. My dining room became a bombsite of homeless volumes, a destruction that permitted the future to exist. We re-recorded. What a show! Clover attacked me, and Deasy was beside himself. He was an auctioneer, conductor of the Philharmonic, a prancing villain in a cloak. Then, as he had promised, we signed real contracts. When that was done, I sat in the control booth while Clover recorded the first commercials. Nothing to lose but your smoker's cough. Oh, Lord, she had the voice for it. Do I root her? Deed I do. Now we did shows with real prizes, the checks all cleared. I spent my weekends in sweet tumescence, my weekday afternoons in the library, and on the road to Cororoit, where the guards at the ICI factory had recovered from their early panic and obtained permission to guide me to certain trees whose bark, they believed, had been used by Aboriginals to make canoes. Being so occupied with my own happiness, I saw little of the Bobsies, and I only learned of their own adventures when Mrs. called on me. "Cough, cough," she cried, knocking on my kitchen door. "Nothing to lose." They had heard me on the radio, she told me. They were so proud to know a famous person. Her excitement was not solely the product of my own success. She and her husband were now Holden dealers, or almost. They were planning to be heroes of the Reckless Red X trial. Imagine that. Around the whole continent, followed by newsreel cameras and photographers. I revealed my ignorance of matters Red X, and she was happy to educate me. The Quotidian brands, Ford, Holden, Plymouth, would take on a gladiatorial persona, armoured against bulls and kangaroos. They would be sticking ugly decals all over a brand new car. Castrol Oil, SPC, Lucas Battery. They would have Bob's Motors written right along one side. She had to go to the solicitors. "Cough, cough," she said. "Bye-bye." I set off to bicycle to Cororoit Creek with my notebook. The wind was at my back as I sailed down the highway, giving myself entirely to this symbolism. For almost 10 miles I flew, until on the long plain near Exford, just where those inexplicable foreign cactus plants grow in the corner of that sheep paddock, my bloody tyre was punctured and I fell and grazed my knee. But even then my luck was good, for I had come to ground exactly opposite a motor garage that seemed to have been freshly decorated for my arrival. Here I found a single Caltex petrol pump, a two-tone Ford Custom line, violent yellow paint splashed everywhere about the concrete forecourt. Bold whitewash had been applied excitedly to the windscreen of the Ford. Low deposit, finance available. As I approached, an old man emerged from the office carrying a ball hammer. He wore heavily oil-stained boots and was disguised by a pale grey shop coat. When his thin white hair lifted in the wind, I recognised the famous aviator. "It's you, Jimmy," he said. When I didn't immediately follow him around the corner, he turned. "You need me to carry you?" Thus I beheld what had been hidden from my view, the eastern day-glow wall with red letters taller than a man. Bob's Motors. Here also was a tap and hose, a big steel bath of the type used to locate air leaks, an air compressor and a battery shed against which leaned the propeller Mrs. Bobsey had so cruelly amputated. "Come here, Jimmy, hold this." He already had the front wheel off my bicycle. The tyre was just as swiftly liberated. He called for the air hose and inflated the tube, and, not without a grunt, kneeled to submerge it in the tank. We watched the air bubbles escape the puncture while the westerly wind whipped dust across our faces. Looking at his stern countenance, I thought of Boreas, the god of wind, the sometimes violent old man with a billowing cloak. In the case of Boreas, it was said he had snakes instead of feet. "There you are," he said. "I suppose you've got your own repair kit. Sorry." He did not criticise me for my lack, and yet, when he disappeared into the battery shed, I felt myself severely judged. He returned without explanation and set to work, drying the tube, washing it with petrol, marking the leak with a white X, and clamping a small black device to the wound. He threw me a box of matches. "Make yourself useful," he said. I lit the match and held it to the patch, startled to see the conflagration thus instigated, like a fuse on fire, hissing, sputtering, dancing around the device. "That's a vulcanizing patch. Did you know that?" "No." "I thought you were a schoolteacher, Jimmy." "I'm Willie." "I know who you are," he said. "You think I would forget you?" He draped the snaky tube across the seat, and while the vulcanizer cooled, we stood with our backs to the vast sign, gazing out across the volcanic plain. The tarpaulins on the passing trucks cracked like sails in a storm, but the wider view was blocked by the battery shed against which the amputated propeller continued to cause unhappiness. Of course, it had been a beautiful piece of design. It had been maliciously damaged. I could not help but feel guilty for my part in that. "How's my boy?" he asked at last. He held me with his rheumy grey eyes. "I miss the little bugger." "I think they're okay now," I said. "I heard he ran off to GM, going to sell Holden's." "They seem happy." "Do they now? You never drove a Holden." "I'm not a driver, no." "Yes, I know that. I had a fellow in here yesterday, Jim Woodall, from out on Long Forest Road. I said to him, 'How's the Holden handling?' You might not know this, Jimmy, but with the light weight in the rear end of a Holden, the handling can get a little hairy. Jim said he had been exceptionally unhappy with the handling, but then he laid a couple of bags of cement dust directly over the rear axle. That almost did the trick. So then he thought, why not? So he took out the rear seat and filled up the well with cement, gravel, water, like he was laying a garden path. When it was set hard, he put the rear seat back, and Bob's your uncle." "You might pass that on to little Titch," said Dangerous Dan, as if he were about to smile. "He might pass that on to GM if he wants to make a living." "Woodall bought a Ford last week, and by the same token," he said, "does he have any bloody idea of how he's going to feed himself?" "I believe so. They seem happy." "Happy? With Miss Lesby friends? Did you clock the way she dresses?" "They're going in some race. There's big excitement in the camp." "What race would that be?" "Not the Red X." "That's the one, I think." What a circus! Dan ground his cigarette into the ground. How could they afford that? Perhaps I'm wrong. In a Holden? I think so. Think? I'm almost certain, yes. Dan picked up the tube without a word. He's not a driver's bootlace, he said. He looked to me. I kept my counsel. He inflated the tire and flung it into the bath. Do you think you can manage to put it back together? Do you have a couple of tire levers I could borrow? Borrow? He stared at me. Sorry. It's a piece of shit, he said, producing the tire levers from his coat pocket, the F.J. Holden. Thank you, Mr. Bobs. A GM helping him financially? I don't know. Whose idea was this? Who did this to my propeller? You knew what you were looking at when you first saw it. You knew its value. I know you did. So tell me, Jimmy, can you imagine what a father feels? I'm the one who raised him. Don't ask about the mother. Don't ask what it cost. Years of sacrifice thrown back in my face. I keep the prop here so everyone can see what I put up with. People are shocked. People who thought they knew him. They thought they liked good old Titch. But then they look at this. Good luck to them, said Dan. And I saw he was once more talking of the Bobsies. How can they go in the bloody Red X trial and have two children? Don't tell me Ms. Lesby's friends will stay behind. I don't know. Here, give me that bloody wheel. I thought, why is everyone suddenly speaking to me like this? He fitted the tube and brought it to its proper pressure with the air hose. Listen to that. You hear that? That's the compressor. They call it free air, he said bitterly. They come in here, don't want to buy any petrol. Can I just have some free air? Listen to the compressor. Does that sound free to you? Go root yourself, I thought. I smiled. How much do I owe you, Mr. Bobs? I'm a Ford dealer, he said, although this was not true. Yes. Come back, he said. Tell your friends. I suffered his handshake and set off towards my original destination, blown forward on the gusting wind. But the further I went, the more I thought of how this benevolence would turn to punishment when it was time to get back home. I turned and came once more past Bob's Motors, with my head down low, my bum high, my legs in agony already. There, beside the Caltex pump, was Boreas, bringer of winter, the devouring one with his gown billowing. What a miracle was Titch, I thought, to rebound against that force.
Chapter 18. At tea time every Friday, we Bobs gathered around our wireless and listened to the quiz and ate toasted cheese sandwiches and were very pleasantly livid that the dumb high school had fired our famous neighbour. He was a dubious, as Ronnie said, but who would have guessed it to see how he lived? His narrow weatherboard cottage was sad as suicide. The roof was rusting, its paint peeling. There was no sign of fame visible from the street, and in person he was just a bachelor with old-fashioned bicycle clips to keep his trousers from catching in the chain. You might see him in the cart buying butter, or pushing his Malvern Star up the Gull Street hill, or trundling a wheelbarrow full of manure he had collected from the sale yards. He was top-heavy in the chest and shoulders, and although shorts revealed a pair of thin and boyish legs, he would, in normal costume, have been mistaken for a labourer from the brickworks. But when Titch took the trouble to add up all his winnings, it was clear our next-door neighbour must be a wealthy man. I was sorry when he began to spend weekends away from us, in Melbourne with his fiancée, as he called her. Who was she? When we heard Bob Deasy, "Now knock that off, you kids," we guessed that Miss Cloverdale was his intended. Barcuba was our neighbour, but we knew him better on the wireless, and nothing to lose was our family entertainment and our education. It was why we invested in that dictionary and fought for its possession.
"He hogs it, Mum! He can't spell cat!"
etc. If anyone ever wondered why a person of Titch's education might say, "It's a cardinal error," It was from his study of that dictionary. Ubiquitous was another word from there. He brought the dictionary into our bed, and I was often awoken when it slipped from his grasp and exploded on the floor. I loved the dictionary in spite of this, but I was fascinated by the competition between the man and woman on the quiz show. Deasy clearly favoured Buck Hooper. He was the king. I was never one of those who wished him to lose his crown, but fair is fair. I was dying for Miss Honeyvoice to get a break. I will not say Bob Deasy taunted her, but he certainly brought out something in her opponent, lovely as he was, that suggested it was his man-born right to win. You better marry that fiancée, I thought. She is every bit as smart as you. I barracked for Miss Cloverdale so loud my family teased me for it. When I noticed her questions getting harder than his, I said so. For example, in what year did Australia have an inland sea? Miss Cloverdale's answer was 60,000 years ago, before the land was invaded by humans from the direction of New Guinea. What clever children they will have, I thought. But no, her answer triggered one of these dreadful-sounding effects, a slow creaking noise, then an explosion, like a tree crashing to the earth. "Mum," protested Edith.
"Mum, they're ganging up on her."
"Wrong answer," Titch cried.
I did not see why he should be so happy.
"What says the king?" cried Deasy. "The correct date is 1827.
Bob Deasy's voice was so happy, I hated him.
"What do you say, listeners? Is it yes or is it no? Australia with an inland sea. Get on the blower. Give us a tingle. You've got nothing to lose."
"Call them,"
Edith begged me. But we were not rich and would never make a trunkline call for fun. We gathered around the glowing dial, hearing telephones ringing 30 miles away. The popular vote was all for Clover, which was pure ignorance, we learned.
"The king is sorry," Deasy purred. "You should see his face, listeners. He's sad to be correct, to defeat the pretty lady. He's sorry to the tune of £500.
He then had Buck Hooper educate us. A certain Maslin map had been drawn in 1827. It included an inland sea, where in real life there were only blacks and desert. There was no inland sea, not ever. Yet because the madman's map was in the State Library of Victoria, so the inland sea existed, and our neighbour was judged to be correct. What tosh! There were bad fires at Belangaroo and Mount Macedon in early summer. The siren rang all day, and the hot wind blew from the north. During these few weeks, when you could smell the smoke inside the hairdressers, the tide of local opinion turned against our neighbour. The new judgment was freely expressed at the co-op and the post office. Buck Hooper was a good bloke. He'd had a great innings. Now let the lady win. Mr. Dunstan obviously did not follow the quiz show. As to the significance of Friday, he had no clue. He assumed there was a place for him at our dinner table, which would have been true on any other night when he might arrive with his plans, contracts, cash flow charts, spare parts inventories. Then I would be quiet as a mouse and listen to him talk, and I would fill his beer glass and not be disgusted by the froth which gathered in his fat moustache. When I demanded silence for nothing to lose, he was offended. Then, when he finally paid attention to the wireless, all he noticed was the prize money.
"You should have told me," he said. "You're living next door to a bank."
"We would never take advantage."
"That's correct," my husband said. "Jeez."
Dunstan looked at Titch as if he should get his wife in order.
"I'm only speaking from a cash flow point of view. We could always use a little more investment in the firm."
"We?" I thought. But my husband did not catch my eye. To be fair, Dunstan did us favours. He found us sponsors for the Red X trial. He released us an FJ Holden demo model before the franchise was officially in hand.
Titch used that demo to sell a record-breaking 17 vehicles. So thank you, Mr. Dunstan, I suppose. Although our success stressed our family to its sleepless limit. In those days, we had to drive 40 miles to General Motors and pick up the cars ourselves. If we were getting one vehicle, then okay. I would drive Titch down with a set of trade plates, and then we would both drive a vehicle back. To pick up two cars meant the train to Melbourne and an expensive taxi to GM. We could have used another driver in the family. On account of this, we missed the quiz show twice. We must have been somewhere in the industrial dark on Dynon Road, past the West Melbourne Stadium, when poor Willie Buck Hooper lost his throne. We did not even notice that it happened, only that he was suddenly in his back garden pulling down his chook house and stacking the wire and broken timber up the front. If we'd even read the paper, we would have known what happened to him. But we had our own worries. Not least my sister claiming she'd been reduced to penury by me forcing her to sell the Geelong house. She said she now was forced to live in a caravan at Barwon Heads. Meanwhile, Miss Cloverdale had become the champion, and Willie Buck Hooper had been replaced by a new challenger. How could I live next door to him and not know? His heart was broken. His life was destroyed. But my main concern was that Ronnie fell out of the walnut tree and broke his arm. Also, Edith was trying for her Herald Learn to Swim certificate. We were sometimes forced to drive the new Holdens home over roads just sprayed with tar, a small enough thing until you understand the value of a new vehicle and the damage this risked. When we hit the wet tar, we crawled at 5 miles an hour, but not even this could save us from those little bits of bitumen sticking to the lower body, then hardening as we rushed down Anthony's cutting towards home. What a nightmare. It was all hands on deck and a rag and a bottle of eucalyptus oil for every one of them. I did not hesitate to rouse up our genius next door. Cough, cough, I cried, not understanding how that must have hurt. If he appeared reduced, I did not notice. I had a rag and a bottle of eucalyptus ready for him, and it was a presumption. I said, sorry, my husband would pay him for his time. We had to remove the tar before it set, under the wheel wells, hubcaps, rims, lower parts of doors. I worked on the front mudguard while Buck Hooper did the door. "That's cough-cough business," he said. "We're very proud," I said. "I'm dead in the water, Mrs. Bobs." And then Edith and Ronnie arrived, Ronnie in his plaster cast, crying because I had not picked him up and he was forbidden to walk home alone, and Edith had twisted his good arm and made him walk past the Catholics, the sale yards, the house full of illegal communists. I dried my son's tears and cooked the tea, and tried to help Edith with her long division. I returned to find Buck Hooper squatting on the grass, thoughtfully removing specks of bitumen. "You're not going to let that woman beat you, Mr. Buck Hooper."
"It's done, Mrs. Bobs."
I thought, it's not too bad. She is his fiancée. "Keep it in the family," I said. But I saw his face, and then the penny dropped. Dear God, I thought, why is life unfair? It was not for me to comfort him. That was why I brought Titch into it. After tea, the kids were clean and calm and happy, and Titch got off the phone and read to them, and they both snuggled up against him in Ronnie's tiny bed. Our neighbour was at home. I could see the light. I washed the dishes, then found my family all fast asleep like creatures in a burrow. I woke Titch and gave him a fiver and a bottle of beer, and sent him visiting next door. And I crept outside and stood in the doorway in the dark, and I could hear their voices, on and on. Then Ronnie was, "Mom, Mom, Mom." He had wet his bed, poor sausage. When he was once more dry and sleeping, I fired up the copper in the laundry and had all the time I needed to wash his sheets and jammers. Then put them through the mangle, hang them on the line, forget the dew and pray for sunshine. I was in bed with my face cream on by the time Titch lay down beside me.
"What a fascinating bloke," he said.
but he had learned absolutely nothing about his broken heart.
Chapter 19. Here's a knocking indeed. Knock, knock, knock. Who's there in the name of Beelzebub? Knock, knock. Who's there at the back door? It's me, called Mr. Bobsey. Why not the front door, then? My sad bachelor kitchen was piled with dead and dying dishes. The roasted leg of lamb. What shade of green was that? Knock, knock. Mr. Barkhuber? I saw the shadow. Birds, I thought. A tumbling troop of them. But no, dear God, I had a conjurer visiting. It's only me. Only? It was the marvellous midget juggling three oranges while he wedged a beer bottle between his tiny knees. Mr. Bobs, I said, please enter. Puss in Boots, he announced, pausing to present a single orange, then heading politely up the hall and into the front room, where he set the beer down before my private map. Up and down the street, all windows were open to catch a little breeze, but I was securely locked, and my front room was as humid as a henhouse. Titch Bobs, a gentleman, didn't even twitch his nose. He had sold cars to Irish bachelors with no time for housekeeping, that is. He was not in the judging business. He came to me as an angelic presence, luminous in his lemon-yellow pullover, dry and sweet as Johnson's baby powder. His cheeks were wide and freshly shaven, his hair smooth and black, and his eyes alive with mischief. I thought, he's like a girl, so pretty and light, the way he listens to you before you say a word about your failure. Beer first, he said, and oranges for pudding. I never drink without regret. But he had already lifted my heart. I found two clean glasses and a bottle opener, and he was immediately busy with his wallet. He offered a fiver, which I declined, and he used his hands with inscrutable good humour until finally, like a child at a birthday party, I found a £5 note behind my ear. "That's for good luck," he said. "You've had some bad luck, I hear." What had he heard? What did he know? That I knocked on Clover's door and found her in the company of an older woman eating my tuna casserole? No one moved. No one spoke. It was impossible to fully understand the situation except I was not liked or wanted. I later discovered that Clover had been a shop assistant, not a schoolteacher, but had I known it at the time, I would have loved her just the same. On the day Titch found me, I was still living amidst the ruins of Jacob Burckhardt and the civilization of the Renaissance in Italy. That exquisite phantom head was resting on my imaginary chest. I was slow to realize he had come into my house with no more motive than you might expect of a kind-hearted child of the Great Depression, ready to pay a homeless man to chop a stack of wood. He sat companionably cross-legged on my floor and poured two glasses. Why had he mentioned Puss in Boots? He didn't know. He didn't recognize Puss's famous lines, "Costantino, do not be cast down, for I will provide for your well-being and sustenance, and for my own as well." And yet surely he wanted something. He was quiet in the way someone might be silent with desire. If he had been a girl, I would not have doubted what was up. But he was not a girl, and he did not wish to go home. And I finally understood that he had seen my map in progress and was waiting for me to tell him what it was. I had not touched my beer, and surely he saw that too, because he filled his own glass twice, but not before insisting I take an orange, and he watched while I peeled in the way my dear pastor always had, making a spiralling snake, an action which produced its own sweet homesickness. "We've all been down on our luck from time to time," he said, but he had become distracted, peering around my sweaty front room, which must have seemed a loony bin, with its interesting slogans, thoughts and quotes, pinned against the blameless wall. For instance, a vast, obscure country. Words which Alessandro Spina had used to evoke the Italian view of his own bleeding Libya, but of course I had meant it in another way. Titch Bobs approached my map like a stalking cat, refilling his glass without looking down. My cartography included a dimension not normally suggested on flat paper. I mean the layers of time. The way the tree with the canoe scar sat in relationship to the effluent discharge. Being aware that he had abandoned school forever on his 14th birthday, I did not expect him to be curious about such scholarly annotations, so how could I guess that he was being drawn, almost physically, across the carefully rendered car park of the Deer Park Hotel and up the Ballarat Road, and hence along the corrugated gravel leading to Digger's Rest and Sunbury, up the driveway of Kippenross, the farm in Melton where the Robinson twins had played such tricks upon the doctor who could not find an appendix scar he had caused just the week before. "You're a surveyor, Barkhuber?" "Good Lord, no." He finished another beer and refreshed it without losing interest in my wall. "What are you going to do for a crust now?" "I've got some savings." "Would you do something for me? It'll sound a little odd. Do you have a set of bathroom scales?" "I do." "Would you take off your clothes and weigh yourself?" I laughed. I didn't understand. I was in the presence of a salesman, which is why I soon found myself walking with him down the hallway, not believing that I was about to stand nude before him, and he, being closely focused on his own objective, would have no interest in my actual body, my privates, my skinny legs, my scar. He produced a stubby pencil and wrote down my weight. "The thing is," he said when I returned to join him in the front room, "the thing is, Barkhuber, the three of us would weigh less than a two-man crew." I would later learn that it was quite normal for Titch to omit certain steps in his thinking process. In his own mind, he had already proposed that I join the Red X as a navigator, so when I asked him what this was about, he was already one step ahead of me. "Petrol," he said, "miles per gallon." For this, I had removed my clothes. "Me, the missus, you. The three of us together. Two drivers, one navigator. We would still weigh less than Lex Davison and Tommy Fox. You get it?" "I was the we?" "Don't tell me the high school will take you back." "No. Is there a quiz show that wants you?" "No one wants me." "I want you," he said. "We want you. You are the bee's knees." "Good grief," I thought. "I could use you to pick up vehicles from GM. I can't even drive." "I'll get you a license, don't worry. The thing is, mate, you are expert in the required field. You can read a map." "Oh, surely your wife." Now, this is where he revealed a second bottle. She'd cooked my balls with the bacon if she overheard. I mean, she wouldn't take it well. "You must never say I said this, but Irene cannot read a map. You've heard the expression, woman driver." I had. "Driving a car is all in the bum, and her bum is a perfect instrument for the job." Was I blushing? Could he see it? "Driving is like an art," he said. "Not everyone is physically or mentally able to do it well. My missus is a better driver than any man I ever rode with." I did not wish to think about her bottom. "Do not repeat this ever. We do not want her to be the navigator." He had been haunted by this thought, he confided in me, mate, from the day he picked up the Red X entry forms. It was an issue that must be confronted, and he dared not give offence in the female department. "And here you are," he raised the glass, a jam jar with Jonquils printed on it. "A bloody miracle is what you are. A chap who can read a map and also..." And also what? Tell me. What? Also speak clearly. My mum was hard of hearing. There you are, a reason for everything on earth. As for the map business, you've obviously inherited it. I did not reveal that neither my mother nor father had any sense of direction, and my Nazi brother was forever getting lost on the way to meet with his fellow Aryans in the Barossa Valley. Instead, I allowed myself a glass of beer and suffered a dreadful hangover which endured into the following afternoon when I found myself reincarnated as the navigator of an F.J. Holden while Titch Bobsey drove like a maniac through the dirt roads of the gnarled Brisbane Ranges, stones ricocheting off the sump, huge trees flanking my vision as he slid through lethal corners. We streaked down long straights into hidden bends or hairpins with dizzy drops awaiting us. He executed a handbrake turn above a precipice, and I came to rest with my head nodding like a plastic dog. Through all this training, I was expected to hold the stack of notes he had supplied me with and to read them out loud above the engine roar. "You see," Titch said, "it's in your blood."
Chapter 20. Beverly said she could never live in the marsh. She would die of boredom. For me, it would be perfect, she allowed, because my life was one straight line. I was Mrs. Average. Her life was like a wrong'un, googly, bossy, a cricket ball that looks like it's going to break one way but then does the opposite. That was her, she thought. But in the end, it would be me who was Mrs. Wrong'un. I wished it was not so. No one ever came to the marsh without thinking, what a pretty town. It was a secret, almost, tucked down at the bottom of Anthony's cutting. If there is a prettier war memorial than our Avenue of Honour, I have never heard of it. Every tree in the avenue was planted for a local boy who died. Every trunk had its own name. The dead boys are now huge elms, and they join together above the road and give a very calm impression. This is how you enter the town. You drive beneath them, up the aisle, beside the apple orchards, the shire offices, the lawn bowls games in progress. You can dawdle through the wide streets and get some glimpse of our boring life. You will find no more exciting noise than the ding-ding of the blacksmith's hammer. On the other hand, there is nothing to warn you of the possibility that Mrs. Bloody Guthrie at the state school might release your children to the care of their grandfather. On the day Beverly arrived, the police were out searching for my kidnapped children. My kitchen was so quiet and fretful that our tiny, ticking little west clocks was getting on my nerves. And then, by Jiminy, all quiet was murdered. Metal ripped and wood splintered, and I felt the floor shudder in my shoes, as if some vital part had been removed by dental pliers. Outside, I discovered, 3 feet from my back door, a car connected to a long aluminium caravan, the side of which was opened like a sardine can. 2 sulky-looking boys climbed from the car. I was stunned to recognize my sister's sons. Fonzie and Theo surveyed my house as if they hated it. They were darkly tanned and had their swimmers on, as did the driver, Beverly, who modeled a bright pink one-piece with no accessory other than high-heeled shoes. She had scraped her caravan along the full length of my house. Meanwhile, Buck Hooper was at the fence, raising his battered hat to her. Men are fools. My sister smiled and nodded, lifting that little nose she had been complimented on too often. "Yoo-hoo!" she called to me. "Yoo-hoo?" I waited for an apology, an explanation. And what were her first words when she reached me? "That's a good-looking man," she said. Even when I drew her attention to the damage, she announced I was the lucky one compared to her. For while her caravan was seriously hurt, my house only required a lick of paint. The phone began ringing. I thought, "Police." The phone stopped. Buck Hooper was staring, I thought, at Beverly's neat bottom. Was he blind to the implication of the caravan? Couldn't he see the warning written across her forehead, the way her whole body was leaning towards me, like a creature looking for a snack, then retreating, rearing, pulling back alarmingly, from the possibility of dire affront? Any listener to the quiz show knows that certain fruits signal their poisonous content to birds. You would think a quiz king could read my sister, but no. He removed his hat and smiled. So this was how Miss Clover stole his quiz show from him. And off he goes, I thought, Mr. Handyman riding to repair and rescue, lowering his stepladder on my side of the fence. I drew my sister inside my kitchen, where she could cause no more public excitation. She did not ask about my kids, which she should have. She was deaf until she had located the wireless and settled herself at my kitchen table with an ashtray and her cigarettes. When I spoke, she hushed me. She just had a horse race she must listen to. Her boys vanished into the shed where a freshly detailed F.J. Holden sat waiting for their smudgy fingers. I made a pot of tea and listened to my sister lose her bet. If I had half a brain, I would have understood why she had no money. "Is he single?" she wished to know. I said our neighbour was a teacher, meaning his wages would be insufficient for her purpose. "He has women coming in and out of there," I said. And then here was bloody Buck Hoover, tapping at the flywire door. He had his ladder and a toolbox, and was ready to do the neighbourly thing to my damaged wall. I would rather not have brought him in, but there was Miss Geelong, clip-clopping across the lino in her clever little shoes. "Beverly Gleason," she said. She was 35 years old, in her bathing suit.
"Willie Buck Hoover," he said.
"What a musical name."
"As in Bach, you mean?"
Beverly smiled and frowned at once. I told Buck Hoover that Mrs. Gleason and I had business to attend to, and dragged the little tart into the living room.
"What are you doing?" she hissed.
I told her to stay away from him. He had suffered quite enough. So then, of course, I must have a crush on him, and I could have slapped her face, but the telephone rang, and it was Constable Lurch McIntyre, who had had a call from Ron Durham to say Dangerous Dan Bobs was causing a nuisance at the Lurdadurg River. "Are my kids okay?"
"No worries," he said. "They're with their grandfather."
He was a moron. He knew nothing. I rang off to deal with my sister and her dirty smirk. If my face was red, it was nothing to do with what she thought it was. I asked her outright, "Where are you off to?" In other words, please leave.
"Caravan parks aren't as cheap as you'd think."
"Bev, I got the same money you got. You can't have spent it all yet."
"I took your advice," she said, colouring as she was bound to. "Everything's tied up. So where am I meant to live? Tell me."
And of course she was my flesh and blood. I had to let her stay here in her bloody caravan. She would be no trouble, honest. But she would suck up my electricity and eat my food. Her kids would fight with my kids. She would clutter up the yard, which was, for now, our showroom. Constable Lurch phoned again.
"Are you acquainted with Theodore Gleason and Alphonse Gleason?"
"You can tell them, Mum," I said, "when you get here." Throughout this conversation, Bev dramatized her poverty, counting out the small change in her purse. I wished Titch was here to read her the riot act, but he was in Footscray to inspect the second fuel tank, which was being tailor-made to fit inside the boot. He therefore missed his father's invasion of our kitchen. With him came our kids, head to heel in mud. Then Constable Lurch, who wouldn't say no to a cup of tea. Then Theo and Fonzie with their smudged upper lips and smutty teenage eyes. Last came Buck Hoover himself. And they all shoved into my place without any invitation, and then, without permission, as if he were a miracle himself. The mongrel Dan upended a chaff bag full of fish. I wished his son had been a witness to the act.
Chapter 21. Mrs. Bobsey was staring daggers at me. The god of the wind was spreading out his arms above his catch. They were redfin, by golly. 20 of them. 30. Beverly Gleason got a big one. 10 pounds at least. Gleaming olive green with broad vertical bands of anthracite across a deep body and bright reddish-orange pelvic and anal fins. She slid her fingers in the gills and lifted, and I saw the pale smooth underside of her brown arm. "Do you want to feel the weight, Mr. Barkhuber? I never knew they grew this big." Did it matter that this same fish had been the constant companion of my tumescent adolescence? Of course. Why else would I be suddenly transported to the weed-rank banks of the secret River Torrens, where it snakes along the edge of Pineham, hemmed by thistle and rusting corrugated iron and stinging nettles and sappy fat paspalum, musty with our amateur desire? I had been too young to buy a French letter in the chemist shops. They would have laughed at me. But there was a newspaper seller on King William Street, Bert, who would flog them to us boys in ones and twos, not without a dirty joke. He had thinning red hair and a sweaty head. "Like putting a sock on a banana," he said. The redfin, Perca fluviatilis, which now covered the Bobsey's lino floor, was the same fish that colonized my childhood river. My pastor papa taught me to catch them with a rod and tin of worms. He never knew how close we stood to the site of fornication. He showed me how to skin a redfin, not judging it necessary to kill them first. There was something very disturbing in the shuddering, convulsive flesh. "Put it down," Mrs. Bobsey instructed her sister. "Go wash yourself," she told her son. She turned on the policeman, whose little finger was crooked delicately around the handle of his cup of tea. "The orchard called you to complain?" she asked him. "They started it," said Edith. "We were just fishing." "This is not fishing. This is slaughter." Edith hugged her chest with her skinny, muddy arms. "The Durhams were there, Mum." "Yes, the river goes through their property." "We were just mucking around, staring in the water at the fish, and Grandpa said, could we eat them if we caught them? And Mr. Durham said, good luck, mate, no one ever catches them. They're too smart for us. They hide out down in the snags." "Help," cried Beverly, as her redfin slithered free, sliding across the lino. "Quit it," said Mrs. Bobsey. "Act your age." Beverly Gleason kneeled before her fish. Only the deep gut prevented it from vanishing beneath the fridge. "As I was saying," said Edith, before I was interrupted, "they gave us their permission. Grandpa told them he's got this bubbling thing to attract the fish." The god of the wind had been briefly distracted by Mrs. Gleason's kneeling form, but he paid attention when his name was mentioned. "Grandpa," said Mrs. Bobsey, "you will have to leave. Grandpa said the fish would come look at the bubbling thing." "Grandpa threw the bunger in the creek," cried Ronnie. Was I the only one who didn't know they were discussing dynamite? "Everyone likes a bunger," said Dangerous Dan, who would later say the same thing to the Sydney Morning Herald. "Explosion is not an activity permitted by a fishing license," said the constable. "Not that this applied in your case, Mr. Bobs, if you get my drift." "You wash yourself," Mrs. Bobsey said to Edith. "You too," she told her sister. "Grandpa bombed the creek," cried Ronnie. He shoved his hands into his crutch and lifted one foot in the air. "Go now," said Mrs. Bobsey. "If you have to pee, go now." "Boom," cried Ronnie. "Boom," and ran out down the garden path and banged the dunny door behind him. The mass murderer of fish was bathing in his glory. He stood in the midst of his harvest and rocked back on his heels and thrust his hands deep in his dustcoat pockets. He raised a flirty eyebrow at Beverly and from his dustcoat pocket produced what might have been a sausage wrapped in fatty brown paper. My mother's Landjäger, to be precise. If there was animosity towards him, he didn't seem to notice. "Everyone likes a bunger." "Oh, Jesus Christ," said Mrs. Bobbsey. "Edith, go to the bathroom." "Now, go." "Dad, a word outside?" "Come on." Dan tossed the Landjäger to his granddaughter. "It's not dangerous." "Get out!" Mrs. Gleason was staring at me, and I looked away. "Only teasing," Dan said. "Barkuba, you haven't spoken." "Leave Mr.